5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about the tax climate here in Wisconsin.
But first, a look at the life and career of Duke Ellington. He's well known as a legend in the jazz world, considered one of the best composers of the 20th century, but the man himself was a bit of an enigma. A new biography hopes to shed some light on who he actually was.
Joining us now is Terry Teachout. He's the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal and the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we just opened with the strains of Mood Indigo. Well, can you tell us about that iconic piece?
Well, it is, I think, probably the Ellington song that's best known throughout the world, the one with which he is most closely identified. And it's one that has a largely unacknowledged collaborator. Ellington was not the only person who wrote it. And that's one of the interesting themes in my book, is the extent to which Ellington's creative process is collaborative.
Well, let's run with that. Talk about his creative collaborative process and how there may have been some unsung heroes along with him.
Very much so. Billy Strayhorn, the most important of Ellington's collaborators, said that Ellington plays the piano, but his real instrument is the orchestra. He wrote all of his music for specific performers, specific instrumental lineups, particular, very distinctive instrumental voices. That's something that he did throughout his career. He wrote roughly, we think he left behind about 1,700 compositions. Of these, most of them are instrumentals, and most of them are entirely by him. But he also wrote a very large number of quite successful pop songs, Mood Indigo being maybe the first of them. And in most of these songs, the songs like Mood Indigo, Sophisticated Lady, In a Sentimental Mood, for which he is especially well known, the melodic material is written in whole or in part by members of his band.
And you call that collaborative. Is that a generous word? You know, I wonder how these band members would feel about it. Apparently, they didn't often get a lot of compensation when he used a bit of their tunes.
Well, it depended on the specific case and the specific musician. Some people were flattered that Ellington wanted to transform bits of melody that they might improvise on the bandstand into pop tunes. Now, others were not so happy, and one, Lawrence Brown, the trombone player, who wrote half of the melody of Sophisticated Lady and was paid a grand total of $25 for it, really never forgave Ellington for what he regarded as very sharp practice.
It's an interesting thought about creativity. I mean, you've got the soloist improvising maybe a different solo every time. Does it take away from Ellington's genius if you know that he saw that piece in there that was the gem, the diamond in the rough?
Not in the slightest, and that's very important to remember, to keep in mind in reading this book, is that Ellington's genius is a given. There's no question about it. It's true that, to take the specific case of Sophisticated Lady, Lawrence Brown wrote the first eight bars, and Otto Hardwick, the alto saxophone, wrote the second eight bars. But it was Ellington who had the idea to put those two pieces of melody together into a 32-bar song, who wrote the arrangement, who structured it, who transformed it from two isolated bits of melody into a full-fledged composition. And the question was it right that he should have paid them $25 a piece, flat fee, for the full rights to the song, and then suddenly their name isn't on the record label anymore? You must draw your own conclusions about that. But it doesn't diminish our sense of Ellington's great gifts as a composer, as a significant musical figure, to know that he did this kind of thing. How it makes us feel about him as a man may be a different story.
Let's give a little listen to a bit of Sophisticated Lady. We have a selection from it. So we heard those two four-bar pieces you mentioned that he spliced together from his two musicians and his orchestra. The two figures, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the personality of Duke Ellington. Let's move on to that a little now. You write that Duke Ellington carried himself like a prince of the realm. How big a personality was this guy?
He was a mammoth personality. He was maybe the first really great, larger-than-life, charismatic figure to come along after Louis Armstrong in jazz. And the specific nature of that personality is central to understanding why he became the public figure that he did. Because Ellington presented himself and was promoted by Irving Mills, his first manager, as a man of great charisma, but also of great elegance, great suavity, beautifully spoken, beautifully dressed. And he was presented by Mills also as not just another run-of-the-mill black band leader from Harlem, but as a major composer, a figure of real cultural significance. That's what set Ellington apart in the 20s and 30s, and that image, which was crafted by Mills and was very compatible with Ellington's real-life personality, stuck with him for the rest of his life, and very profitably so, too.
Now, you talked about his charisma and his bearing. He had a regal air about him. Is that part of how he was able to get some credibility for jazz? It wasn't necessarily the most respected art form at the time that he was on the scene.
Absolutely, and he was always thinking about respectability. Remember that Ellington, born in 1899, grew up in the black middle-class community of Washington, D.C. He was not like Louis Armstrong, who came from the roughest block in New Orleans, whose mother was a prostitute. Now, he was a man who valued respectability in his own personal life, even though he didn't always live by its tenets. He wanted to be seen as respectable, and he thought that respectability would project itself onto jazz. The word jazz itself, for Ellington's generation, was identified with sexual matters, with sexual intercourse. That's why he didn't like to use it to describe his music. He liked to call his music Negro folk music. He thought that that was classier, and he thought that it would increase respect for the music he played in the world community, and I think particularly in the white community. It was important to him that jazz not be treated just as a minority music for dancing, but as a music for the whole world, a music that was as serious in its own way as classical music.
And in his creative process as a composer, he was really trying to live up to that concept, wasn't he?
Yes, very much so. You understand that Ellington is not, he's not putting on airs. In the first place, he really is like this. In the second place, his music is a fusion of you might say highbrow, middle-class, respectable, classy sounds, and the earthiness and directness of the blues, which is also part and parcel of the sound. Ellington believed that the strong contrasts were one of the most important aspects of his style, and you see them in his music all the time.
So he has that air that you're talking about, and he had the credibility that he brought to jazz and the respectability. On the other hand, reading about his life, when you've only heard his music, it's kind of difficult because he did have, you know, a womanizing side to his personality, a side that was not always that generous, it seems like, to his fellow bandmates. How was it for you as a biographer, sort of uncovering that side of Duke Ellington?
Mm-hmm. That's very much the case. The front cover of Duke is a photograph, very rarely seen, that dramatizes the sides of Ellington. You know, he's seen in profile. You know, he's composing, got a pencil in his hand, working on a piece of music. But you see the side of his face, the left side, that you don't normally see when he sees a piano on stage, and you see that there is a large crescent-shaped scar on his left cheek. Well, Duke tells the story of how he got that scar, which briefly is that around 1927 or 28, his wife, who found out that he was catting around pretty aggressively, went after him with a razor in bed one night and said, "I know what you've been up to, and I'm going to spoil those pretty looks." He was out the door seconds later, didn't even stop to put his clothes on, and he carried that scar with him for the rest of his life. It's a reminder of the high price of paying a life, of leading a life that is respectable on one side of the coin, less so on the other.
We're talking with Terry Teachout about jazz great Duke Ellington, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Sorry, 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Duke Ellington? Do you have a favorite song, a favorite composition? Do you have a question about his life? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll take your calls right after this break. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about Duke Ellington with Terry Teachout. He's drama critic for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Duke. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions about Duke Ellington or maybe a favorite composition. 800-642-1234. We're going to check out probably his most famous piece. So we're in the bridge of Take the A Train there, co-written with Billy Strayhorn. And I wanted to talk about Billy Strayhorn a little more. You mentioned him briefly earlier. How important a collaborator for Duke Ellington was Billy?
He was the most important of Ellington's collaborators. He came on board with the band in 1939 as a very young man. Ellington immediately saw his potential, and Strayhorn became the band's chief arranger and co-composer. So valued by Ellington that, as we just heard, he actually wrote the band's theme song, Take the A-Train. But Strayhorn was a figure who did not appear with the band in public. Basically, he functioned in the shadows, wrote music, sent it in. Ellington played it. Ellington gave him credit, but since Strayhorn wasn't there, people tended to suppose that the music was by Ellington instead of by Strayhorn. And what was going on here was that Strayhorn was homosexual, and he knew that he could not really lead a public life as a musician back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and then also lead the kind of private life that he wanted to lead because he was very much at ease with his sexuality. So he stayed out of the spotlight, left it to Ellington, and as a result, Ellington too often got the credit for things that Strayhorn actually wrote himself.
It sounds like they had kind of a rocky relationship, too, and I've read, you know, he wrote some cutting remarks that Duke Ellington made to him, you know, to the effect of, well, you're more of a behind-the-scenes guy anyway, more of a contributor, and I'm sort of the front man. Did that make things more hard?
Well, it was just going to be a complicated relationship anyway, because it started out as a father-son relationship. Strayhorn had an abusive father. He meets Ellington, the great genius. Now, they really take to each other. Ellington opens up the great world of professional music to him. And whenever you have a father-son relationship between two very gifted people, strains inevitably creep into the process. Eventually, Strayhorn became uncomfortable with the so to speak, bargain that he worked out. And in the 50s, he actually broke with the band for a few years. They worked it out, and Strayhorn remained with the band, writing for Ellington for the rest of his life. But it was a relationship that was not without its difficulties.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Chris with us in Evansville. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I guess I just wanted to say, first of all, I've had a lifelong love of Duke Ellington's music ever since I've been a child, mainly due, I guess, to my father's love of the music and having it in our house all the time. And I remember reading a biography of Duke Ellington, and I wish I could remember the author, but I can't. And in this book, it was talking about an incident where he and his band were staying at a hotel, and one of the other band members was making a remark about a woman at the hotel and calling her a whore. And Duke Ellington's comment was, "Don't you realize that when you look into her eyes, you may be looking into the eyes of God?" And I just, he seems to be a man of such contrast. And I do know that he wrote a religious piece. And I wonder if you could make a comment about that, as well as maybe some of his spiritual beliefs.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it hasn't come up in this conversation yet. But Ellington, for all his devoted pursuit of women, was also, in his idiosyncratic way, quite devoutly religious. Later in life, he wrote three full-length works called Sacred Concerts that were expositions of his faith. He was absolutely serious about it. It did not stop him from pursuing the ladies. But he was a complicated man who, as Whitman says, could contain multitudes. And he could contain both the carnality of his sex life and the spirituality of his religious life. And he was at ease with both sides of his personality.
Is that why you were laughing, Terry? The contradictions sort of inherent there in what you know about him?
Yes, but also, Ellington, he was a guy who knew what to say at any given moment, and he liked to say it in his elegant and polished a way as possible. And I chuckled at the thought of Ellington, you know, being challenged by a particular woman, and what he comes back with immediately, as was his way, was a compliment.
Talking about how Ellington talks, I was wondering if it makes it hard to be a biographer of him. You recount a story, I think, in the introduction, where Duke Ellington is talking about a song he wrote, Harlem, in the title, and how you can hear the sounds of Harlem and so on. But actually, the song had a completely different title when it was composed, so that wasn't what it was about at all. Is that a common theme in trying to write about Ellington?
Well, I think what it points to is that you can never take what Duke Ellington says about himself, about his music, you know, about the time of day at face value. Somewhere in the book, I say that he was a man who spoke not to reveal himself, but to conceal himself. He was intensely private. He had a lot of secrets to keep. But his personality was fundamentally oriented that way anyway. So when you're writing about him, you just have to remember that he may or may not at any given moment be telling the truth. He may be embellishing it. He may be making it up completely. You check his statements out.
Let's give another listen to a song. It's a shame to talk about Duke Ellington so much and not play a little more music. How about In a Sentimental Mood?
Oh, yes.
So I play saxophone on a level that would not be tolerated in Duke's orchestra, but I have played that song, and it's a wonderful melody. Can you talk about that one a little?
Yes. Well, in fact, the man you heard playing the melody, Otto Hardwig, is the man who wrote the melody. Once again, as was Sophisticated Lady, Ellington's contribution to the proceedings here was to take a melodic fragment gleaned from the playing of one of his musicians and transform it into a full-scale composition. It's also, let's just put it this way, not a bit bluesy. It's not any kind of cliche notion of jazz, or for that matter, of blackness. It is explicitly, deliberately sentimental, and Ellington said, when challenged on this, that that too was a part of the black personality. He understood that there are no simple answers to the question, what does it mean to be a black person? And he wouldn't settle for them in his life or in his work.
I want to take another phone call. We have Randy on the line from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was sort of compelled to call because that put me in a nostalgic mood. I had a chance to meet Duke Ellington in 1972 after one of his concerts at Camp Pendleton, California. It cost me all of $2 to go see him. And I only had a few moments to talk to him, of course, but I also sought out Paul Gonzalez because I was quite a fan of his. And we talked for quite a while, and I got some real insight the fact that none of the band members were youngsters, and they had this grueling tour schedule that I could barely, you know, it was more common to rock and roll bands, and and I was seeing that they liked Paul Gonzalez was the man who introduced me to Jack Daniels, but I could see that a lot of them really liked their liquor, but I guess I was just calling because, like I said, that's a really fond memory for me. But I also wonder, what was it like touring practically up to the time he died?
That's a great question, Randy. What about his touring schedule?
Well, it was grueling. There's a photograph in my book of Ellington taken in the late 60s. It's one of the few unposed casual photographs of him we have. And, you know, he's standing up in front of the band. He's at a rehearsal. His collar is unbuttoned. And he looks old and tired. And you can see the results that this kind of grueling schedule had had on him. On the other hand, for the most part, he really thrived on it because that was the life he liked and that was the life he knew. He used to say, I only go home to pick up my mail. And he wasn't going home to compose either. He wasn't composing in the privacy of his studio. He was composing in his hotel room. He was composing backstage at theaters or in nightclubs, dressing rooms. That was the way he operated. He wanted to have that band there every night to play the music he'd written that afternoon or the night before. That was the way he wanted to lead his life.
Just briefly, you end your book by observing that when it comes to Duke, everyone knows him, yet no one knows him. in doing this research, writing this extensive biography, do you feel like you know him?
I feel like I know some things about him. I think I know him a lot better than I did when I started working on the book. But I can say no better than all of the people whom I quote, friends, lovers, colleagues in the book, who all agreed that they didn't really feel in the end that they knew what he was like on the inside.
All right, well, we'll leave it there and we'll go out with some music by Duke Ellington. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
That was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Terry Teachout. He's the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's tax climate. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we explore the essentials of good taste through three popular foods. That's ahead in our Food Friday segment.
But first, a look at Wisconsin's tax climate. Some have blamed the state's stagnant economy, slow job growth on high taxes.
According to a new report released by the financial publication Kiplinger, Wisconsin is actually a medium tax state.
So is Wisconsin really a tax hell? Was it ever? Mike Ivey is with us. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Before we get to the report, this issue, how bad are taxes in Wisconsin, this is one people have been back and forth on for quite a while now, isn't it?
Well, it certainly became an issue in the last governor's race, but I mean, if you go back even to Governor Thompson, it was an issue back in the 90s, so it's still out there.
And one of the arguments that keeps coming back and forth is, does it depend on how we measure? If we're talking about taxes or fees and lumping those in together, it's harder than it would sound to compare us to other states.
Yeah, you need to be careful when you talk about taxes, because if you just talk about straight flat tax rates, states where incomes are higher, the ability to pay is greater in those states. One reason Wisconsin has sort of had that reputation as the tax hell is because our rates weren't particularly so high, but our incomes compared to a lot of states are not that high. So we're sort of middle of the road on incomes, maybe a little higher on the tax end. And as a result, when the Census Bureau does a survey of the total tax burden, we ended up in that top five range for a long time. What's interesting, guys, is that beginning in 2005, Wisconsin started to sort of go the other direction. And by 2007, we actually were out of the top 10 in terms of taxes based on per capita income. So we're now in we ended up ranked 11th in the last time they did that. So, you know, things have been kind of going in the right direction. If you don't like paying a lot of taxes, nobody likes paying taxes.
So there's this Kiplinger report now that you wrote about. What did they find about Wisconsin compared to the rest of the country?
They didn't put a number on it, but we were not in the top 10. And if you go to our website, captimes.com, you can see I've got a lot of the data up there, and we're in that white sort of mixed category, and they've got a map up of all the states, but you can see Minnesota, least tax friendly, Illinois, least tax friendly. We're in the white with Iowa and Michigan, called mixed. And then, of course, you've got the most tax friendly states, and these would be states that don't have any personal income tax, like Texas and Florida and Nevada, and some states don't even have a sales tax, states that do enough, raise the money other ways.
And how up to date are these? Do they get the most recent property tax cuts?
Kiplinger, even if you read the report, it talks about the income tax cuts that were passed as part of the last budget. It didn't talk about this last little tiny property tax cut they did. But property taxes are really a good issue. I think one reason people in Wisconsin get so worked up over taxes is we use the property tax to fund so much of our schools and local government. And that's that bill you get every year in December, and it looks like a big number versus your income tax, which is, you know, taken out of your check as you go along. So Wisconsin, more than other states, does rely on that property tax to fund schools and government, and then you end up with that bill. So I think that really works people up.
What have you heard as far as reaction from this new report?
I'm just reading off the comment board, which is sort of how we measure a lot of public reaction nowadays. And, you know, you end up with the usual back and forth. A lot of people think that, or make the argument that, yes, paying taxes is what gives us good schools and good services here. And there was a real good comment on my story from somebody who said, you know, for a long time, Wisconsin sort of went along and people paid taxes and we all seemed to get along and had decent schools and a high quality of life, and it's only become the past. I think the recession brought a lot of the discussion on, too, you know, when everybody feels tight on cash, then taxes have become a bigger issue.
And how about official reaction or groups like the Taxpayers Alliance? What do they make of these things?
Taxpayers Alliance, they were the ones that pointed out that you can't just look at rates like Kiplinger was doing in its report. And they do their own analysis. Again, that's linked on our story here. And they've got Wisconsin 11th highest in the country on what they call total tax burden. Again, that's looking at fees, taxes, weighed against per capita income.
So extending out the argument here, tax-friendly, tax-unfriendly, however you want to define states, does that then necessarily mean business-friendly or business-unfriendly?
Well, the other numbers that I've seen out there, usually coming from business groups, they've still got Wisconsin in the pretty unfriendly business category. But I think it's important to remember that the first budget under Walker, this would have been the 2011-2012 budget, it removed income taxes for factory owners and farm owners. So if you're involved in a manufacturing or an ag business, you are no longer paying any income tax in Wisconsin under something called the Manufacturing and Ag Tax Credit. That kicks in 2014, and that's probably the most significant tax change Wisconsin has made in decades. And the argument was we need to encourage the so-called job creators by eliminating their tax burden. And WMC, the Wisconsin Manufacturing Commerce, had been pushing for this for several years. When it finally was included in the budget 3 years ago, it was hailed as the biggest change ever. Now, whether that is going to suddenly cause companies to move here or expand, I guess that remains to be seen.
Mike, as an eagle-eyed reporter, you may be aware there's an election for governor coming up next year. Do you see people looking at numbers like this and trying to figure out how they play into the spin in the year ahead?
Oh, I'm sure taxes will get batted about. The line from the governor will probably be, do we want to go back to the tax and spend policies of the previous administration? I don't know what Mary Burke's going to say on taxes. She's talked about being business friendly and comes from a business background as well, but it's going to be one of the issues out there. I don't think it'll be the main issue. I think people are still going to, hold the governor to his 250,000 jobs pledge. There've been some signs that the job creation is ticking up here a little bit. I think the announcement that Amazon wants to build a large distribution center in Kenosha, I think that's a big issue. That may have something to do with the fact that they I don't think they'll be paying taxes on that facility, if I'm reading everything correctly.
And you mentioned in your piece, I think, the previous administration, the Doyle administration, said there was some movement on some of these tax ratings even then.
Say what you want about past Governor Doyle, but I don't think he got the credit that he probably deserved for making a lot of those tough decisions that Walker talks about. But think back, Doyle had a hiring freeze on. He had vowed to cut 10,000 jobs. He instituted the furloughs. He did a lot of that sort of stuff to try and rein in spending that he didn't get much credit for. But if you look at when Wisconsin really started to move out of that top five taxing states, it was under Doyle. So I think there's some irony there.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Time now for Food Friday. Our next guest has written a guide about the 50 foods he thinks every modern gourmet must know, with an emphasis on tradition and simplicity.
He says knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world, and it's necessary for living a good life.
Joining us now is Ed Baer. He's the founder of The Art of Eating and the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you said that knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world. It's necessary for good life. Why?
Why? Oh, boy, put me on the spot. I think, you know, good food eating, deliciousness is about sensuality. And I think that's a part of life that maybe the Puritans up here in New England haven't always embraced, but I think it's important. You don't really understand the natural world, for instance, without a feeling for the senses, and food is a huge part of our experience of the senses.
Well, this new book of yours, it looks at the top 50 foods. Well, not top 50, but the 50 that you feel are essential. How did you pick these?
Well, you know, everybody wants me to say that they're the best foods or my absolute favorite foods. But if I just chose those, there might not have been any balance. I mean, I don't know. I love cheese. So maybe there'd be 49 cheeses plus butter or something, which is perfect.
That would sell in Wisconsin. Yeah.
We're in dairy states. So they're foods that I love, but I wanted to have, you know, I wanted to have lettuce. I wanted to have green beans. I wanted to have beef. I wanted to have caviar and a few unusual things. I wanted chocolate. So I love all those foods, but there is a bit of a distribution.
And as part of this, that, you know, these are often kind of foundational foods. You know, for instance, we'll be talking about eggs today, and eggs go into lots of other yummy dishes, desserts and custards and omelets and souffles and all that kind of thing.
For sure. No, they're kind of, I mean, as I've written about it, they're really, they're architecture. They're the foundations for so many other things, and they're delicious in themselves. And they produce so many textures, really luscious textures sometimes.
Well, we picked three to talk about. We couldn't possibly cover all 50, but I think we picked three good ones. We've got beef and eggs and chocolate. Let's start with beef, because that's something that Americans have been eating for a long time. What do we need to know about beef?
Well, beef, the bad news for me, from my perspective, is that the beef in supermarkets has been going downhill a bit over time. The cattle are slaughtered younger, less care is taken all along the way. The good news is that, of course, meanwhile, at farmers' markets and at different other sort of less mainstream stores, the quality of meat in general, and it's certainly led by beef, has been going up, so that there's really delicious, flavorful beef out there. And for me, yes, you can have really delicious, totally lean beef, but for me, and I think most Americans, the beefiest taste has some kind of a balance between fat and lean, between flavorful fat, and sometimes we hear that, I don't know, all the flavor in meat is in the fat, but that's not true. There's also very flavorful meat, especially when the cattle have been raised partly out on pasture and outdoors, so you get really flavorful so-called, you know, free-range cattle. Range is, of course, the key word in the past.
Right. Well, and there has been some debate over what cattle should eat for the most flavorful beef. And, you know, it seems as though the trend had been to feed cattle, you know, corn or sometimes grain and not grass. Where do you come down on the grass, corn?
A little bit in the middle. Certainly you want a lot of grass, and the corn feeding isn't even all that old. I mean, it's decades old, but it's not sort of the primordial way of raising cattle. And as my position, and it's not perhaps the most scientific one, but is that a certain amount of corn isn't so harmful for cattle, and so finishing cattle on corn isn't up to a point, isn't all that bad. But you can finish cattle and get a very rich marbled meat on grass. It just has to be really rich grass.
How do you have rich grass?
You have rich grass. You have to, it has to be the right time of year. You have to live in a climate that has good rainfall, and Wisconsin would qualify. You have to have a well-managed pasture, for instance, because I'm more familiar with pasture being here in the East, that is allowed to regrow. I mean, if you just let the pasture be untended, tall grasses aren't so good. You want them at a certain height. They're, at that point, they're the richest in nutrition, that sort of thing.
It's interesting to me that in France, it sounds like where you consider sort of beef central, they really know how to produce good beef. The cattle aren't slaughtered till they're five, some of them, or 7 years old.
Well,
and here,
that's more historical than good economics for the present. I was really talking about a prime point of reference.
Ideally, we would be able to do
I mean,
this,
something but... over 20 months. There's no firm age. It depends, of course, on the the flavor depends a lot on breed. It depends upon the way it's raised. I don't know, even time of year, diet, of course, as we've been talking about. So there are multiple factors, but it takes a certain amount of time for a plant to accumulate flavor and also for an animal.
Now, at the end of each entry, you give sort of suggestions about how to prepare the ingredient and what goes well with it in terms of wine and complementary ingredients. What do you suggest with beef?
Oh, boy, all kinds of things. Now you scare me that I'll contradict what I've written, but I'm a big fan of anything onion. Roasted onions are good. Roasted root vegetables, very good at this time of year. If you go in a completely different direction, you know, you could have a béarnaise sauce with tarragon. Cognac, even in the sauce, kind of enriches it, going in an extreme there. But there are all kinds of other things, and you know, they don't have to be rich and heavy. There can, you know, a lettuce leaf under a grilled steak is super classic and super good.
All right, well, let's move on to something especially yummy, timely with all of us eating candy for leftover from Halloween, chocolate. What comes to your mind when you think about what makes truly excellent chocolate?
Well, it's kind of that there are almost two kinds of chocolate in the world. At the risk of oversimplification, one is the chocolate almost every one of us, probably every one of us, grew up on, which are familiar names that we won't mention here at the moment. And there's nothing wrong with them, and they make people happy. But there's a kind of a second sort of chocolate, and it really has to do with the quality of the beans and the trees they come from, that has much more fruit flavor, even floral flavors you can find in it. So those combined with roasting flavors and bitterness to create a full chocolate flavor. And those, for me, are more interesting, especially the fruit and flower components. I mean, people talk about chocolate almost the way they talk about wine, and maybe it's a little tedious, but, you know, cherries, different things, you know, orange, different things that people think they taste in that chocolate. And for me, that's a much more interesting experience.
Now, you're talking mostly about dark chocolate here, which it sounds like is your partial to. It sounds like you don't really want to waste your time with milk chocolate.
No, it's kind of true.
And I won't even get you started on white chocolate. But
yeah, no, I think I wrote that was one of, in the whole book, I think that was one of almost the only things that I just say are abominable. But you know, perhaps it's a matter of taste.
All right, well, you talk about a process for chocolate that I was unaware of, conching. Mm-hmm. And apparently it's not controversial, but it's a choice chocolatiers make about whether to conch or not to conch. Can you tell us what that is?
That's true. In times, years past, they would, in Europe, for instance, it's very typical to conch it. It's a refining process, and they don't even completely understand what goes on. But it's textural. It has to do with flavor, and they used to conch for even several days. Now it's a matter of hours, and there's some, you know, very fancy chocolates that will even tell you just how long they were conched. A chocolatier that I talked to, who's in Massachusetts, says that when he conches and he goes home at the end of the day, his wife can smell just how strong it is because there are off flavors that come out. And what this process is, it's a machine. The original one was shaped like a shell, thus conch. And it just basically turns the chocolate over and over. It's just constantly keeping it in motion. And that goes on for, as I say, hours and perhaps occasionally still a few days.
Interesting. Okay, well, we got to get to eggs, but last question. You say chocolate kills wine. So what do you do if you want to have chocolate and wine?
What you do? Well, you could go for more alcoholic beverages, meaning, you know, certain fortified wines, and also particularly not a great Bordeaux, but something with strong, intense flavors, and there are oxidized wines, for instance, certain strong, sweet sherries that have been aged for a time, not necessarily expensive. And then there's a wine that I especially like called Banyuls from the south of France and the Mediterranean just by the French border, and another one from the same place called Mauri. And you can get a Mauri that's not too expensive. And those can have just their sweet flavors. Somehow there's enough alcohol and sugar to stand up to the chocolate and enough intensity of flavor, and you get some really special combinations with chocolate.
But in general, you've got a really expensive wine. Don't waste it with your chocolate.
That's really true.
Okay, so what about eggs? You know, obviously fresh is good, right? Should you go for the freshest egg you can find?
Yes, I would say without doubt, except for the notion that a super fresh egg is harder to peel if you want to peel the boiled egg.
And are you partial to the different eggs? I don't know. I've since I've been frequenting farmers' markets more frequently. And they're so beautiful, some of these eggs, and the pastel hues. They look like little pastels from Impressionists or something. Do you have a favorite kind of egg?
No, you know, I don't. I have to say I don't think that more beautiful eggs necessarily taste better, although I used to always get blue ones, and then they were really wonderful, and I began to associate the blueness with better taste. But I think the science is that it's much more the way the chickens are raised, whether they're outdoors, whether the eggs are fresh, what they're fed, that makes much more difference than the breed, like, you know, Rhode Island Red or one of these fine old familiar names.
In our last 20 seconds or so, what is your favorite thing to do with eggs?
Oh, gosh, I think a souffle. I think just because everyone else says they fall so easily and I can make them rise without trouble, I just like to make souffles.
Wow. I wish we could make you come here and prove that. That sounds fantastic. Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking to Ed Baer, the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste.